This is the Reason Podcast, and I'm your host, Nick Gillespie. You know, just when you might have thought that economics was finally played out as a way for us to understand the world, along comes today's guest. This is a very special episode of the Reason Podcast, and I'm convinced ahead of time that it's going to be one of our most downloaded as well. Alison Schrager is a PhD economist who writes for Quartz. She's a journalist, and she's also the co-founder of Life Cycle Finance Partners, a risk advisory firm. She teaches at NYU, but the reason I'm talking to her today is because she has written one of the most interesting books I've read in a very long time. And the interesting stuff starts with the title, which is An Economist Walks Into a Brothel. Now, this isn't a memoir about living a double life or anything like that, unless she breaks some news during this podcast. But in fact, what's interesting about this book and what's fascinating about it to me is that it's all about how to understand, quantify, and minimize risk in all different parts of our lives and in our society as well. It also carries with it an implicitly and at times explicitly, I think, libertarian message about intentionality and responsibility when it comes to living life to the fullest. Alison Schrager, thanks for talking to Reason.
Thank you for having me.
So let's get right to it. Your book is about the economics of risk, but you begin it in a brothel, and it's the famous Bunny Ranch in Nevada that was run by Dennis Hoff, who was running for Congress, I guess, or some office and died last year. What brought you to the Bunny Ranch, and what did it teach you about risk?
Well, I was at the Bunny Ranch before for an earlier story I did on negotiation skills, because they have a really effective negotiation training program. And when I was there, I got to know a lot of the women, talking to them about negotiation skills, and I was really surprised at how much more they charged than the illegal market. So the illegal market is, you know, ordering a sex worker online, which happens all over the country all the time. But that market is all underground and a lot riskier. And I was surprised that they could get away with charging so much more, because you have to go all the way to Nevada, as opposed to the convenience factor of just, you know, being able to order a sex worker in your city. So,
and this is also, I mean, in other markets, illegal markets, like if you borrow money from a bank, mm-hmm. the interest rate probably is going to be lower than if you borrow it from the mafia.
Exactly. Right? Yeah. So, and particularly in whether or not an illegal market charges more than legal market usually comes down to who has more market power. And that is, you know, how plentiful something is. So I would have thought the opposite. So it dawned on me, it was a really interesting risk story. Also, I'd written on sex workers a lot in the past, and risk was so much at the forefront of their minds. You know, how to manage risk. I mean, the whole concept that some guy is already someone who's looking for sex workers online, you know, no judgment, but you know, you get some dodgy characters who do that.
Sure. And I'm sure you get some of the finest people who have ever, for instance, lived in the governor's mansion in Albany and whatnot. So,
yeah,
but it's a mixed bag.
It's a very mixed bag, and that you're going to be fairly vulnerable in a private place with them.
So it's risky for the, what do the workers at the Bunny Ranch, what do they call themselves? Do they call themselves prostitutes?
So I've learned this. Prostitutes refers to the streetwalking. It's okay. A very segmented market. So the prostitution is usually the streetwalkers. Higher end or middle to high end call themselves escort. But sex work, I guess, is just the generic term. Yeah.
So are they escorts at the Bunny Ranch?
Yeah.
So it's the escorts, I mean, the Johns or the clients are minimizing their risk in various ways.
They are.
And then the escorts are as well. Talk about, you know, what do the escorts get out of it? Because part of what you talk about in that chapter is how much of their earnings the escorts give to the house.
A lot. So anyway, the prices look huge. Yeah. Like, you know, I think I found an average price at $1,400 an hour. Mm-hmm. That's not their take-home pay. They have to give right off the bat 50% to the house. And because they're working legally, they're 1099s, they actually have to then pay taxes, like full self-employment taxes.
And if they're getting 1099s, then they're contract workers, I guess.
Exactly.
Right? Okay.
So that means they have the self-employment tax on top of it. So, I mean, we're talking 30, 40% on top of that.
Yeah.
So they probably would make more money if they worked in the illegal market.
Oh, well, they would probably take home more pay because they could skimp on taxes and they wouldn't be kicking out as much. But they wouldn't be able to command the same price, right?
They wouldn't.
Yeah. And why is that? What is it that the customer willing to pay extra for?
He gets safety too.
In what ways?
Well, I mean, if you do order a sex worker online, there's quite a bit of a danger involved. You don't know who she's going to be. She could blackmail you. She could look really different from her pictures. It could be a police sting. And in fact, the way sex workers do try to minimize risk in the illegal market is they do this very thorough screening. So they're probably going to be calling your place of work and confirming your identity, which makes a lot of potential customers uncomfortable for obvious reasons.
Yeah. And they're disease-free.
Disease-free. Right? They're screened for diseases every week. Yeah. I mean, the whole thing is monitored by the health department.
Right.
So it's about as close to risk-free sex as you can get.
Well, you know, there's always a risk when you open your heart, right? Or your wallet, I suppose.
Well, I also have a theory that's part of why it's popular. I mean, seeing this up close and not really relating to it in any way, you know, everyone always expects me to really be grossed out by the Johns. Mm-hmm. And most of them are just really lonely people. Mm-hmm. And there is something comforting, especially I think this explains why the girlfriend experience is the highest premium service.
Okay, explain that a little bit.
So this is like more than just, you know, almost no one who goes in there just wants sex and like in and out. That's actually called half and half. Mm-hmm. You said we could get a little dirty. And I get going on the brothel, I lose my boundaries.
I hate to tell you, but this is so far not so dirty. Okay. But you got a long way to fall.
So half and half is like straight sex. And that's actually like maybe 20 minutes and doesn't...
Why is it called half and half?
It's a half blowjob, half sex.
I see. Okay. Thank you.
Yeah.
And I think I have just outed myself as a naïf in this.
Most people are. You know, this when you're in the brothel, you start learning the lingo and you start just saying the most obscene things to everyone in public in front of children because you lose all sense of boundaries.
So you were saying, though, so people don't want, or the most of the customers don't want just the half and half. They want
the girlfriend experience, which is they want to take their time. They want someone to listen to their problems. They want someone to cuddle with. They may even want to go out to dinner or like, have a bath. And there's a huge premium on this service. One, because it's more emotionally taxing on the women, too. But mainly, I think there's a risk premium in that. And that most of the men I encountered who came to the brothel were just lonely and crave intimacy. And like straight up half and half doesn't provide that. And I think a lot of people fear intimacy. Mm-hmm. Are afraid to put themselves out there. So there's something almost risk-free in this encounter and that you get this illusion of intimacy, but no real, you're not really having heartbreak on the line. There's no fear of rejection.
Talk a bit about Dennis Hoff, because he, and you mentioned like you went there to do a story about the negotiation stuff. And one of the things that's fascinating about him as a figure, and he was much beloved when he died, his funeral. I mean, there were celebrities and just hundreds of people there to say their last farewells. But I mean, among other things, he's teaching the escorts that you don't have to do anything you don't want to, and also to negotiate for price. What's going on there?
Well, I mean, I was always really attracted to this story, in part because I found Dennis Hoff to be so fascinating. Mm-hmm. I like people who make me have complicated feelings about. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you can't deny, as uncomfortable as you might feel about what goes on there, that he did a lot for these women. You know, the first thing he made them do when they got there is set a life goal beyond the brothel. Like, do you want to go back to school? Do you want to buy a house? And then you work towards that goal. And then he provided them with financial planners, business training, really great negotiation training. Because he once said to me, he's like, this is not a great job. And most of them are never going to last more than a year. And most of them are never going to make this kind of money again.
What kind of money are they making?
You know, I think, I mean, I profile and I talk to mostly about the women who are the super high earners, mm-hmm. who might be earning $500,000, $1 million a year. But that's definitely outliers.
Right.
I think typically it's more like maybe $100,000, mm-hmm. which, you know, isn't bad.
No, it is certainly not bad.
No, especially, I mean, I was meeting women there, especially they came from families, a lot of them, where, you know, people don't even have bank accounts, where a lot of the men aren't working. And they had no experience with money before they got there. And now they're like telling me that their, you know, IRAs are invested in passive funds. Mm. I mean, they really, you know, are learning these skills. And a lot of them, sadly, no one's really taken that sort of interest in them before.
Hmm. Now, you know, one of the things that is really memorable about the book is, your reporting chops are great, and you mm-hmm. build each chapter around a different kind of entrepreneur or individual figure or group that is doing something. And in the chapter about brothels, it's Hoff. Describe a little bit about what he was doing before he got into the brothel business, because he is kind of a visionary in a weird way. And I know you're not like an uncritical supporter of him, but it's also like he's a pretty fascinating character who has empowered a bunch of people who really didn't have anything.
That's what I love about him, is I love the contradictions in him. And because I think, you know, we look for these pure heroes or pure villains, especially in these times. But often, you know, you get a lot of shades of gray. And there was something inherently sleazy about Dennis. But, you know, he, because before he was at the brothel, he was in the other thing people think are sleazy, which is timeshares. Mm. And he had this idea, and this is going to sound so offensive to so many people, but it was kind of a good idea, that sex work was effectively like selling timeshares. You know, you're kind of like renting.
And, you know, all you have to do is say that. And yeah, and then you, everybody can fill in the details, right?
It's kind of true, but kind of horrible.
Yeah.
So he took that same idea of before the brothels were sort of these dingy places where these women were effectively in trailers forced to work long shifts where they're not allowed to leave. And if a man came in, they had to do whatever he wanted for the whatever house price. And he was like, he set the business up like timeshares, where they were effectively like these individual people selling timeshares, where they negotiate every price, where they never have to do any sex act they don't want to do with anyone they don't want to.
So it's, I mean, you know, and again, I want to talk kind of broadly about risk and then go into some more specific examples that you run through in the book. But so what you learn, what the economist learns in the brothel is that people are willing to pay a premium to reduce risk. And that includes the prostitutes or the escorts and the clients.
Yes. So the spread, This is interesting because I always thought of pimps as people who force people into risky situations and extract a rent from that. And what Dennis did is he set up a situation where he created a spread between buyers and sellers, and that spread was a risk premium they each paid, and then he took the risk premium on both sides. Mm.
Yeah. So he's visionary in that sense too. I mean, a pretty savvy entrepreneur.
Like an insurance company.
Yeah. Okay. Which I suspect, you know, the way most people think about their insurance companies or their agents, they're kind of like pimps or something.
Well, and that was the idea, is that, you know, I had worked in finance over the years, I'd studied it in academia, and it's just, you see this stuff everywhere once you start understanding
it. So talk about risk. I mean, generally, what is the category of risk and why is it so important? And yet it seems to be so neglected. I mean, part of what you're doing with the book is saying, you know, we've had, you know, kind of freakonomic type analyses of a lot of stuff, mm-hmm. but not so much with risk. You know, what is risk and why are we slow to kind of recognize it and talk about it?
Well, I mean, it is true that people are somewhat uncomfortable with risk, but I think risk science isn't just well understood. So to me, you know, I don't think most people, when I tell them, even still are surprised when I say, well, it's financial theory, because finance within economics is the study of risk. And even in economics, finance remains fairly siloed from other areas of economics. I mean, you're doing so much pricing and macro policy without thinking about risk or the financial sector at all, which is actually kind of, you know, causing a bit of reckoning in the academic economics community. It's mm-hmm. not as interesting.
Right.
But I mean, this is true everywhere. So risk is technically in finance. And I think this is a good definition just to go with, because risk often is poorly defined. People say it's a risk is just what's the worst thing that can happen. That's not risk. Risk is, to me, a measurement of the future. So the future is unknowable, but you can make an estimate of what you think might happen. A whole range of things might happen. And there's a rough probability you can put on all the range of things. It could be good things. It could be bad things. You would never take a risk unless you thought a good thing would happen.
And we're afraid to kind of grapple with that. Is it because it's complicated, or is it because we don't want to really, you know, kind of envision the worst thing that could happen?
I think it's just one of those things we just haven't taught people. Hmm. I think people actually are very good risk takers. I don't buy that we're just doomed by these biases that make us unable to grapple with risk or unable to comprehend the worst case scenario. I think it's just, you know, people don't understand the science is there, mm-hmm. Relatively, because it's relatively new,
right?
And don't really see how to apply it. But I see people generally being great risk strategists in one area of their life and not understanding what they're doing technically. And once they do, they can apply it to all areas of their life. Because I think we are naturally good risk takers. But now that we have more research in science and data, we can actually take those lessons or take a good risk decision in one area and apply it everywhere else.
Which is what the book does. And, it, you know, in a broader sense, it's fascinating to me. I'm 55 and I grew up in a kind of lower middle class household where I guess my parents, you know, my father had a defined benefit pension. Mm-hmm. So like, you know, and then at some point, I guess they bought some mutual funds or something. But like, all I'm saying is like 30 years ago, many fewer people were in the market at all. Mm-hmm. And like, you know, the news didn't lead with what the S&P 500 was doing necessarily. And there's just been this great learning curve over the past generation or two to start thinking about economics. And I guess finance or risk comes a little bit after that. And so we're getting to this conversation.
And I think that's right. I think you bring up a good point, which is maybe why we haven't really learned about risk, is because for a long time, the economy was structured that someone else would take on your risk. Someone took on your retirement risk. Even jobs were lasted longer. Mm-hmm. You had stable salary increases that were predictable. So you had all this predictability, so you didn't have to really think about it. And this is what inspired me to write the book, is my work doing retirement innovation, is that we've put this huge risk problem on every single household.
But which is not necessarily a bad thing, right? I mean, I want to be in charge, I guess, unless I really screw it up, but I want to be in charge of my retirement because I'm going to have to live with the consequences. But yeah, it is, and I guess this is true when you read all of the accounts of underfunded 401ks and things like that, we're going to be in a world of hurt sometime over the next 20 years.
Maybe. Probably. I mean, defined benefit plans weren't that great.
Yeah, no, of course not. But you weren't thinking about it, right?
About it. But I mean, in some ways that poses a bigger risk because, you are in charge. If someone underfunds your defined benefit plan and then your company goes bankrupt, you take a huge haircut on that.
Yeah.
And you have no control over that. I mean, the reason why we got rid of defined benefit plans is they were super expensive. And in fact, more people now have access to retirement plan of some kind than even the glory days of defined benefit plans, in part because they're cheaper, so they can be more accessible.
Well, and this is, one of the reasons why, and we'll talk a little bit later down the road about your personal politics or ideology. Mm-hmm. But I mean, to me, this is very libertarian of like, I blend libertarianism and existentialism, and it's kind of like you're going to be living with whatever you end up with, so you might as well take responsibility for it earlier. Mm-hmm. Speaking of kind of economic anxiety and people managing or minimizing risk, you hung out with a paparazzo, right? That's the singular of paparazzi.
Is it?
Yeah, and it's the name of a character in Fellini's 8 and a half, I guess. His name is Paparazzo.
I actually don't know this, but I should.
Okay, so, and then the plural is paparazzi, and that's that, but it comes from that Fellini.
It's Paparazzo?
Movie. Paparazzo.
Okay.
In any case, you hung out with a celebrity photographer.
I did.
What did you learn from that experience about risk?
Oh, so much. They are living this very sort of secret, fascinating world, which honestly, I found more interesting than the celebrities, which is, you imagine if you're a paparazzo, you face incredible risk in terms of your income because, you're effectively hunting. Like going out with them was really fun because you're hunting for celebrities, then you see one and it's so exciting.
Yeah. It's like playing Pokemon Snap or something.
Yes. Only you get paid.
Yes. But you might also have a bad outing and then you don't get paid anything.
More often than not. Yeah. But when you have a good outing, I mean, your income is so variable depending on.
So talk about, I mean, what were, the guy that you were hanging out with mostly was going after Alec Baldwin, right?
Well, one day. Yeah. I mean, they all congregate around the corner because that's where Gigi Hadid lives.
Uh-huh.
And this is sort of like a corner a lot of celebrities live in.
Yeah.
So that's where they all congregate.
Yeah.
He took me out for Alec Baldwin. Another time we saw another starlet. I can't remember who.
And how much money could could a photographer make with a good shot?
Well, if you have a good shot where something newsy is happening and it's a big event, I interviewed the former photo editor of Us Weekly. And I mean, in the past, I mean, I'll get into it later of, how the market's changed. Mm-hmm. But even now, if you got like a celebrity embroiled in an affair, something like that, or the end of a relationship of a hot couple, you could get like $500,000.
Wow.
But most pictures now, the Just Like Us photos, the pictures of people just wandering the streets getting coffee is like $5.
Wow.
So you see, this variability is enormous.
Yeah. And you talk about in that chapter that there's, the individual risk and larger risk because that whole industry has radically changed with the advent of cell phones and everybody having a camera. And also the distribution is now digital rather than through paper. So there's that kind of risk, and then there's the up and down of the individual. Talk a bit about
that. In finance, we call individual risk idiosyncratic risk, which is the risk an individual stock will rise or fall. Facebook, you buy a Facebook stock, what happens with Facebook determines your portfolio. But there's also systematic risk, which is the risk the entire market will crash like it did in 2008. So the paparazzi,
all of them.
Face a lot of both. The idiosyncratic risk is that you get that money shot in any one day. But then they also face this extreme systematic risk that the whole market has totally changed. I mean, between celebrities posting on Instagram, between the digitization, which has changed the business model for all the agencies they sell to. So I talked about Just Like Us Photo being $5 an hour. There used to be something called the Gold Rush era, which was like Lindsay Lohan, Paris Hilton peak years, where you would get maybe $15,000 for that photo.
Wow.
So there's been these huge market changes. And what was interesting about this is in finance, idiosyncratic risk is managed quite easily, is you just hold a lot of stocks. Because if you hold enough stocks, you don't notice one going up or down. And this is why people buy index funds and mutual funds. They do the same thing by forming these alliances. All the paparazzo like form an alliance and then they share tips or royalties, depending on the arrangement, or they might just be partners in like a 2-week stakeout. So what you're doing is you're pooling your risk.
But then there's also a bunch of defectors in that, right? Sometimes.
Well, there's a million economics dissertations going on here.
Yeah.
Because there's also, you also make the most money for an exclusive.
Right.
So you always have an incentive. I mean, these alliances even get names. Like they're not like, there's no legal contract, but they're fairly informal within the community.
Right.
So you get these cute little names. And but they are inherently unstable because people are always cheating on their alliances.
Right.
And then they fall apart. But then the idiosyncratic risk is so great, they have to reform in some contest. So you're out there with them and they all hate each other.
Sure. So it's so in other words, even that, it's like every other workplace, right? Now, you use that chapter also to talk about economic anxiety. And that's, I mean, kind of in many ways, I guess that industry is similar to many aspects of contemporary life, where it seems as if, and I'm not, you know, in some cases I think it's exaggerated, others not, but it seems as if whole industries are rising and falling on a, you know, on an almost quarterly basis, and that's difficult to manage, right?
It is. It's very, and it's more terrifying. It's more an existential risk to your career,
right?
I mean, I think, you know, one thing that fascinates me as an economist is, you know, we talk so much about how bad it is for people and how terrible the economy is. Although if you look at any metric, people really never lived better.
Right.
By any way you could think about it. And yet people are so anxious. And I think they're anxious because they feel this existential threat to their careers. I mean,
is it true? I mean, you mentioned before, is the average job tenure, and I realize that's almost an impossible metric to define in any meaningful way across time, but are people having fewer job or are people's job tenure shorter than they used to be? And do they have to jump into new careers more than they used to? Or is it merely the feeling of that, which would have the same effect psychically?
But it's complicated. It's a hard question, because if you just look at median tenure, you will see that it's actually increased, and which is totally averse to what everyone thinks about the job hopping millennials. But it's a little more nuanced when you look at it more carefully. First of all, one reason why median tenure has increased is, you know, from the 80s, is you have a whole generation of women who had actual like lifetime careers, as opposed to before, women have babies and leave their jobs. So you really have to look at it as a male only problem, just to separate that effect. And then even when you do that, you can see median tenure sort of being flat or going down or increasing for men too. But that's mainly because before, it's like a third of people at any given moment had been in their job for less than a year. Now what you see is very short tenures, a little less common, but very long tenure is also less common. So the lifetime job has gone away, but you're also getting, I suspect it's just better matching. And it might be to be better information, better technology, you know, people are more educated than they used to be. So you don't have these sort of very short jobs. People find a job, they stay there for 3 or 5 years, and then they move on.
Right. And it could be, I mean, I know from conversations and researching you a bit, so as a journalist, I mean, you've worked at a variety of places, Bloomberg and The Economist and Quartz. So it's, you know, that's different if you're moving among similar jobs than if you started out as like a ditch digger and then you had to become a journalist and then you have to become a dishwasher or something.
Well, this is the difference between idiosyncratic or systematic risk in your job. An idiosyncratic risk would be the risk that your individual job just doesn't work out. So, you know, you don't get along with the culture. It's just you have a bad manager or whatever. You just move to another job. And I think that risk has always existed. But the systematic risk is now threatening, it feels like, every job.
Yeah, and and this is where I wonder how much it certainly has changed journalism in the past 30 years in radical ways, and it continues to restructure and be redefined. But I wonder sometimes if, because it's affecting journalists so much, they control the means of representation, you know, that every industry is going down the crapper or something.
Yeah, and I think, I mean, I personally am a techno-optimist. Mm-hmm. I think that, I mean, maybe because I was a student of the Industrial Revolution for so long. And, you know, there was a lot of anxiety then. So I feel like I've heard all this before. But I think, you know, there's a pervasive, you know, feeling of, is AI going to take my job? And everyone kind of is worried about this. And we don't really have good solutions. So I think people, even if some of the fears maybe, you know, are exaggerated, I think the fear is real.
Yeah. And I guess it's true in the Industrial Revolution, or at various phases when there's major dislocations, there's a huge amount of improvisation that happens. Nobody can really plan for that disruption, but then you come up with something that opens up a whole new industry.
Humans really are great at making themselves valuable. Mm-hmm. And in some ways, I find, as I said, having studied the Industrial Revolution as long as I did, interesting about a lot of the fears people have now, because people are very, you know, anxious that they don't have this steady job they can rely on. When one of the things that was really hard about the Industrial Revolution was getting people to adapt to steady jobs. People were used to having so much more autonomy. And the idea that like men had to go somewhere and have some other man tell them what to do all day and sit there all day was just horrific for them. And it took like a generation of social conditioning. That's why we actually have universal education,
right,
to get men to be willing to do this sort of thing.
What's going on in horse breeding farms in Kentucky? You had a kind of, that's actually far more voyeuristic than the brothel chapter, in fact.
That was the raciest chapter by far. So I was looking into the economics of horse breeding. And it's an interesting story. So that is actually my chapter on modern portfolio theory. And modern portfolio theory is this idea in economics that Harry Markowitz came up with, which is that, you know, just not the diversification I talked about with the paparazzi. It's that there's this optimal way to diversify. Like if you get the exact right combination of stocks, then it's sort of like the only free lunch you ever have in finance. Like the holy grail in finance is how can I get more but not have to take more risk, because risk is the cost. Downside risk is the cost of going for more. So there's this idea that if you have the exact right magical combination of stocks, you can get more and less risk. So I discovered with horse breeding is that since 1986 tax reform, which really made long-term investments a lot less valuable, people became a lot, I mean, it already started a bit before, but it really took off in the 80s, this idea that you're going to sell your horses after 1 year instead of breeding a horse and then racing it. You just sell it after 1 year and someone else races it. So the problem is that one...
Wait, what was it in the tax code that...
So that you wanted to realize your returns earlier.
I see. Okay.
So it's also another... So you want to get rid of the risk. There's not much upside to hold it to racing your own horse anyway. So people everywhere now, effectively every horse that's born is going to be sold within a year.
And these are thoroughbreds, I mean, racehorses.
Yeah.
You know, so these are... All the Donald Trump kids, right? And you want to sell them before they actually reveal how good or bad they are in the market.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But you know, you have to sell. You know, these are expensive creatures.
What do they cost?
I don't know.
Okay.
Because I was more in the stud market.
Okay. Well, let's talk about studs then.
So the thing is, at that 1 year point, you only know a couple pieces of information. You know who the parents are, and you get some sense of muscle tone at that stage. But both those things seem to favor inbreeding because, you know, there's only so many sires that people want. So if that's one of the crucial pieces of information, that one sire or that handful of sires become a lot more desirable. So they become a lot more expensive. And what you ended up getting is a significant uptick in inbreeding since 1986.
And that's because it's a way of minimizing risk, I guess. Or, it's assumed that when you know the parentage, and particularly the sire, why is the father horse or, you know, the sire, why is he considered more determinative than the female?
The mare is considered more determinative.
Okay.
But the thing is, you have a mare.
I see.
That's yours. You can choose who the sire is.
Ah, okay. Yeah. And so what do they diversify? Like, what is the portfolio?
Well, they're not diversifying. Okay. That's the thing. They end up inbreeding these horses. And, you know, if you don't diversify, you know, you end up with a very large range of outcomes. Like, maybe the stock you picked is going to be the next Google, Or maybe it's just going to be the next pets.com.
Well, let's put it in terms of the English royal family.
Yeah.
Right? You're either going to get Edward or Harry or somebody. Like you get Prince William. Prince Harry seems a little better, although he might be outbreeding. Uh-huh. We don't know, right?
Yeah.
Depending on the rumors. So that's fascinating. But horse breeders are, because you also talk about how there's even evidence that horses are slower now than they used to be.
Yeah, see, on average, the thing is, if you bring two horses that are kind of inbred but have great qualities together, there's an upside shot. It's a long shot that you're going to end up with this perfect combination of characteristics that's going to be the next Secretariat.
Right.
But on average, you do worse. So it's better to sort of match up horses that have complementary characteristics. They're just kind of a little bit more above mm-hmm. average. You want right. above average.
So because there's, what is it, regression to the mean or reversion to the mean or something that...
Or it's just like, it's really complicated to make. You don't know how these things are going to plan out. Mm. Like, for instance, Secretariat had a super large heart. I think 3 or 4 times larger than everyone else's heart, other horses' hearts. But, you know, you can't just breed a horse to have a large heart because everything has to be in tune. Is it one guy explained, it's like you have to be a real genetic freak to run that fast. Mm. And if you just take all these sort of like, well, this one has a big heart and this one has the right hip, and you put that together, you don't know how it's going to work out. So it's better to go with just solid above average characteristics.
And does that carry over into portfolio diversification, that risk diversification?
Totally, because yeah. if you just diversify with a lot of very solidly performing stocks, you know, you're not going to be that person who bet it all and made a fortune on Google, but on average, you're going to do better.
Right, because this is also one of the hard truths is that the market does better than any of the, over time, tends to do better than any of the individual actors in the market.
Yeah, exactly. And it could be one reason, I said, this sort of more inbreeding, you know, there's a lot of reasons why horses are getting slower. But, you know, inbreeding could be part of it.
Right. Because it's also, you know, there's tighter drug testing. The tracks are a little bit softer because they want to protect the horses more. So there's
yeah.
other factors.
There's other factors yeah. that probably honestly are a little bit more significant.
Another example, and then I want to go back to talk about stuff a little bit more generally, but you sat in on a safety conference held annually by big wave surfers.
Uh-huh.
And again, you know, this is one of the things that makes the book really compelling to read is the reporting. It's a great blend of, you know, really finely tuned, detailed reporting and then these large theories. What did you learn from the big wave surfers?
Well, you know, it was the best conference I've ever been to, you know, obviously. And it was fascinating.
You obviously have never been to a Star Trek convention, but.
No, but I have been to my share of pension risk conferences. And it amazed me how similar it was in so many ways. And that we're in this windowless conference room in the North Shore of Hawaii. Everyone's dressed a lot more casually
right.
than they are at pension conferences.
And I'm betting their cores are a little bit tighter than the typical risk finance professor.
Everyone's in great shape
yeah.
and super tan and, you know, really cool.
Right.
But effectively what we were doing is, you know, they learn different – there was this guy I profiled, the one who brought jet skis to big wave surfing. And he is actually like a very thoughtful risk scholar. Like he had this revelation he was telling me one day, I think it was in the 90s, where he's like, risk is something that can be managed. We don't just have to go out in the world and just take whatever comes. We can actually be thoughtful, manage risk. So we had this idea that he would educate people on risk management. So a lot of what went on at the conference was actually very similar to the finance conferences I go to, which is post-crisis, everyone in finance is obsessed with systemic risk, which is knows that if you take risks, you pose risks to other people. And that's exactly what they're doing because surfing constantly comes up with these new technologies to make surfing safer.
And it's kind of fascinating that you meant like one of them tells you that they're not necessarily an adrenaline junkie.
No.
I mean, that because that's what you assume, that these are like daredevils who just want to go over falls in a barrel or something. But actually, that's not it.
Not the big wave guys.
Yeah.
I mean, if you're surfing an 80-foot wave, you can't be reckless.
Right.
They're actually quite nerdy. And in fact, even finding that big wave takes a lot of math. So most of them, when they're not surfing, are home on their laptops downloading data and feeding them into models.
Wow. So, and then what does that, how does that carry over into discussions of things like insurance? And you have a conversation with them about the Peltzman effect. What is the Peltzman effect?
So the Peltzman effect is that, you know, when you feel safer, you take more risk. So, And not only that, in addition to the Peltzman effect, is that I talk a lot about risk management tools, both mm-hmm. insurance and hedging. But what's interesting about them is that they can always be flipped around to take more risk. Mm-hmm. So you can use like an option as an insurance against a stock price falling too low, but you could also use it to take more leverage and double down on your risk. And that's what they're doing a lot with the surfing technology. Hmm. Like I mentioned, the guy who's sort of the risk guru was the one who got jet skis to big wave surfing. And jet skis are just very similar to stock options in that way, and that they're used, initially they were brought in as insurance. If you wipe out, there's someone there to rescue you, who can just rescue you from drowning. But they can also be used to push you on bigger waves. Hmm. So the existence of jet skis both enables more risk and also makes people feel comfortable taking more risk. And this is a big concern to the surf community. Initially, it was leashes. Then it was jet skis. Now it's inflatable vests. Is that all these people are going to be taking these bigger risks and exposing everyone to more risk, because if you get caught out, you know, it takes resources away from other people. You know, it can just be dangerous having someone who doesn't know what they're doing on the water. So really what we did was I sat around with all these surfers in a windowless conference room and debated systemic risk.
So there are multiple other chapters that cover things like poker playing and kind of emotional investing mm-hmm. and whatnot, war and battle and unexpected events, the cruise ship, mm-hmm. you know, industry, ton of stuff, but all equally fascinating in the details that you bring to bear. How did you get interested in risk and economics more generally?
Well, I'd always been interested in economics. I think, like a lot of economists, I grew up in a community that had a bimodal income distribution. People were either upper middle class or very poor. Mm-hmm. And
this was in?
Stores, Connecticut.
Okay. So the town where UConn is. University.
Exactly. And I was, I think, unusual in that I had professional parents, but was multi-generational there. Mm-hmm. So I always felt a bit more of a connection to the poorer students. So I think the fact that why was poverty so persistent was something that really haunted me as a kid. And I never understood Keynesian economics. So,
well, did you come to any kind of eureka moment of why? Was it because people didn't understand risk, or was it something
No.
else?
Well, yeah, kind of. I mean, I now have a lot of thoughts as to why my community I grew up in has the problems it does. I think there's a lot of... we see this a lot now, which is very troubling everywhere, is there's a lot of ambivalence about growth and progress. Anytime, you know, you have this huge, I grew up in a big market failure, which I think is very common amongst a lot of economists, which is you have this community that really, like, everyone likes to talk now about, oh, if you have a university, that's an automatic growth miracle. It really isn't. It can help. It's definitely, you know, especially you have a community that used to be a lot of factories that shut down, and then you have this huge university. Like, there's no reason why stores shouldn't be like Ann Arbor in a lot of ways. But it's not, because you have a community that's very resistant to change. When people want to build anything there, it gets shut down. And any sort of development, people were very wary of. And I think that is a big reason why they perpetuate so much poverty there.
So how did you go from being interested in economics to be interested in risk in economics?
So for some reason, even as a 20-year-old, I was really fascinated by retirement, which I've never really seen as an old person problem, which is this whole idea of how you turn money today into money in the future, and how you do that, and how you make these decisions, which is a very interesting question to me, because it's sort of the purest of all questions in economics. So I did my PhD in macro public finance, which is generally where personal finances ended up in economics for reasons that I don't understand. But it was more of a macro perspective. And then after grad school, I ended up working with Robert Merton, who is a famous financial economist, and he taught me finance. And I was just like, wow. So I started thinking about risk and how it relates to value. And anyway, I'd seen finance before. I never really realized that was about. And then it was just this huge intellectual awakening for me of, this is a better way to understand the economy. It's more rigorous. It's more interesting. We've got more data. And it has all the answers I was always looking for.
Are you, when you look forward, and when I think ALEC, the organization, American Legislative Exchange Committee or whatever, they just came out with an annual report about how much in unfunded liabilities for public pensions there are. We hear all the time about underfunded private pensions. I mean, are we... you know, is that iceberg, you know, on the horizon going to sink the Titanic here?
I don't know. It's definitely a risk. I think the thing is about pensions that drives me crazy is, you know, people say underfunded pension. It's like, you don't know how it's going to go. Odds are a lot of states and cities are going to need some sort of bailout. Either that or services are going to have to be cut to individuals, or taxes are going to have to go way up. And a lot of places that are underfunded are the places that are already losing people.
Right. So this is like the state of Illinois or the city of Chicago, certain California cities.
Yeah. Or in Michigan.
And I guess there's always that negative cycle, right? Where it's the people who screw up the most that need the most help, but they have fewer resources.
It's going to be very interesting how it plays out, because the federal government so far has been very adamant they're not going to step in, because, you know, then that will just, the iceberg will totally take the Titanic down. But they might have to, and it's going to be, it's disturbing to watch, especially as the states and cities continue to be so irresponsible.
And it probably, I mean, from a policy angle, I assume, you know, just because of the way politics end up, that it's going to be the worst of all possible worlds. So people will take massive haircuts, mm-hmm. taxpayers will kick in more, and we'll probably finally have a glorious explosion of inflation, right, that we've been worried about for decades.
Well, it's interesting is, you know, you can't cut benefits mm-hmm. unless you're in bankruptcy.
Right.
And so you bring up a good point, which is, the way they're kind of doing backdoor cuts is by getting rid of the COLA extensions, like the mm-hmm. cost of living increases.
Right.
Because in a lot of states, they're finding that that's a nice loophole of, you can cut benefits by taking care of inflation. But because inflation has been so low for so long, people are sort of not really caring.
Yeah.
But if inflation goes up, that's going to really bite.
Besides Merton, who are some of your intellectual heroes?
Let me think. Well, definitely Merton is a big one. You know, I'm a big fan of Joel Mulcair's work. He's mm-hmm. an economic historian.
Right. The Lever of Riches. And he's I don't know if he's a techno-optimist, but he's certainly a techno-determinist.
Well, right? He's a techno-optimist
yeah.
for sure.
Yeah.
I mean, you talk to him and he is just so excited for everything that's mm-hmm. coming out. He's like, CRISPR's going to be amazing.
Do you worry in that context? And he's, I guess, at University of Chicago, right? Mm-hmm. An economic historian. He's written a number of books about how technology changes things. Do you worry at all about, you were mentioning AI before, but just kind of when we get to a post-scarcity world mm-hmm. where effectively, you know, housing, food, medical care is kind of taken care of, like, will that, and or is that what we're starting to see, a kind of crisis of, you know, what do we do all day? Because all we're doing is symbolic acting, really, more than, you know,
I don't think we'll ever
food.
Come to that.
Really?
Yeah, I think people always want more. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you think about it,
so we'll never have a post-scarcity world because people will always want more. So they're
scarcity. I mean, we used to feel like all we needed was food.
Right.
But like our expectations for what it is we need are always increasing. I mean, you used to be pretty happy if you had food and lived till 30.
Right. Yeah. But and now we want better and more intense celebrity photos and whatnot.
Yeah.
So you chose not to pursue, you have a PhD, you chose not to pursue a traditional academic route. Why not? Because that's kind of risky, right? I mean,
yeah.
You know, but.
Well, economics is unusual in that usually, you know, getting an academic job in most fields is like winning the lottery. But economics, you know, I guess we're super rational. So there's actually enough academic jobs if you go to a good school. But, you know, I mean, I went to graduate school right out of undergrad and I just was going to all my interviews and I just desperately didn't want to be there.
Mm-hmm.
So I definitely drove my whole committee crazy, graduated without a job and ended up at The Economist.
Right. And how did The Economist in particular, given its name and mm-hmm. its lineage, did you find, and it's known as a kind of champion of classical liberal mm-hmm. analysis and whatnot, did you find in journalism that even business writers or economics writers are particularly interested in economics or knowledgeable about that?
Some more than others. You know, it depends. I think it's like anything. I think even some academic economists are very narrow-minded.
Yeah. Do you have a politics or an ideology that informs your economics or where you look for stories?
No. I mean, I what I like to do is, I think I... If there's one thing I believe in, it's markets. Like, I love markets. I believe they work. As I said, I grew up in a market failure.
Right.
So I think if...
So you also admit that they fail at times, right?
Of course.
Yeah.
But why they fail is an interesting question. Sometimes you have these naturally occurring things that make, you know, markets hard to be competitive. Sometimes, often, you have distortions. that keep them from functioning. I mean, if I just believed markets work perfectly and economists have no job to do.
Right.
But I do think generally markets more often than not have this quirky way of working that I find fascinating.
What is there an explanation for that? Is it kind of like Hayekian diffusion of knowledge or an ability to that markets allow us to harness all of this scattered information or something?
Humans have an innate need to make their lives better and to try for more and to make themselves useful. I mean, for me, markets are like water. It's like you can throw a big boulder in the stream, but it's just going to find a way to go around it. It might be less efficient because it had to go around it. So I think what drives me as a journalist and as an economist and has always been the one common thread is I just like exploring how they work and how they work when there's hurdles and how do some natural hurdles come up.
Mm-hmm. If you can leave people with one bit of advice about risk, other than buying your book, of course, mm-hmm. An Economist Walks into a Brothel and Other Unexpected Places to Understand Risk, what would your advice be?
It would be to take more risks, but be thoughtful about the ones you take.
Okay, can you explain that a little bit?
Yeah, because I think we tend to think about risk in these very binary terms, like either a risk taker or you're not. Like either you're like surfing an 80-foot wave mindlessly or you're sitting at home watching Netflix. But really, we need risks to improve our lives. Like you're never going to get anywhere in life. You'll never have a satisfying relationship. You'll never have a great career unless you take some risks. But if you take risks in a smart way, you know, it's not a guarantee things are going to work out. There are no guarantees, but you can increase your odds of success by a lot.
All right. Well, we'll leave it there. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
We've been talking with Alison Schrager. She's an economist who writes for Quartz, and she's the author of the excellent new book, An Economist Walks into a Brothel and Other Unexpected Places to Understand Risk. Alison, thanks for talking.
Thank you.
This has been the Reason Podcast. I've been your host, Nick Gillespie. Thanks for listening. Please subscribe to us at Google, at Apple, at Reason, at Spotify, or anywhere you get your podcasts on.